Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. David, I got a lot to talk about.
That's
today.
Right, Josh. How are you doing?
Good. I've been a little under the weather, my two sons are in a new school this year. So between those two things, it's been sort of like I've been a little less up to date on the news.
It's a busy time transitioning back into the classroom.
Yeah, I need to find out from you guys some of the stuff that's going on. But I know there's like a lot. I know there's a lot of stories that are going on. It's just that I don't know enough about them.
Well, we'll catch you up.
Yeah.
Joining us as always, Kate Riga. How are you?
Good. Hello, everybody. And sad I'm not back to school.
Yeah, totally. And a very special guest, Nicole LaFond. How are you, Nicole?
I'm good. Very special.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Josh, like you said, a lot to get to today. But before that...
Yeah, I guess, okay, we'll go right into talk about Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee, which I actually have a supply of right here.
That's who I am.
Yeah, a couple of us have it.
One else.
Yeah.
You didn't know that that's part of the contractual obligations of
the
podcast.
Breaking news in the cold brew world, Grady's Cold Brew is now shipping all of its liquid products nationwide. Now everyone has access to all of the products that made Grady's famous. 32-ounce bottles of New Orleans-style concentrate, 42-serving bag and boxes, and even single-serve bottles. Drink it straight, mix it with your favorite milk, or spike it for a caffeinated cocktail. Grady's is brewed and bottled daily at their brewery in the Bronx, so bottles ship cold for peak freshness. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 20% off your first order at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. All right. Got that out of the way. So what are we talking about today?
So we had Corey Lewandowski, the President Trump's former campaign manager, in front of the House Judiciary Committee yesterday, spent a lot of time stonewalling Democrats and not answering questions. Then this week, we are covering climate change in a more serious way. And Nicole has written a piece up on the site right now about some of the various ways that the Trump administration has rolled back or weakened kind of the Obama administration's efforts to fight climate change, protect the environment, things like that. Then finally, we will touch on this Brett Kavanaugh story, which started in the New York Times over the weekend. It was a Sunday Review opinion piece that was an excerpt from two Times reporters' book looking into the Kavanaugh confirmation fight and the sexual misconduct allegations and so on that he faced in the confirmation process just about a year ago now.
Yeah.
I think it's like exactly
almost
a year.
Exactly a year ago.
Almost exactly a year ago. Because it came like, it came, you know, right, you know, a month or two out from the midterm election. It was like be a bad thing for what, you know, according to the Republicans, it was going to be a bad thing for the Democrats.
And energize Republican voters.
Right. Which it may have actually done in a couple Senate races. It clearly didn't do anything for them in the House.
Yeah. So the House Judiciary Committee has sort of been wink, wink impeachment investigating, right? Mm-hmm. Pelosi obviously has been not wanting to go too far down that road, but Nadler, who's the chairman of the committee, has kind of admitted as such, like, that these are kind of investigative or, you know, impeachment inquiries. And so yesterday we had what was basically the first hearing kind of in that effort. Is that right, Kate?
Yeah, right. I think we've also seen Nadler in recent days kind of getting a little bolder about his personal feelings on impeachment. And, you know, we'll get to this at the bottom of the show, but there are a lot of dynamics for us to delve into there, you know, even more than just the kind of coming from a law standpoint and a politics standpoint, but also, you know, Nadler's got his own primary to contend with. So there's a lot for us to unpack there.
Right. So yesterday we had Corey Lewandowski appear in front of the committee for, I don't know, like 6+ hours, maybe 7 hours, something like that. Spent a lot of time not answering questions, basically invoking executive privilege from the White House, saying, You know, the White House has instructed me not to share any details of conversations I had with the president or his advisors and so on and so on. It's one of those things where Democrats on the committee were trying to ask questions basically to try to, you know, uncover either Trump's wrongdoing or just corruption in general. And Republicans were basically saying, isn't this all just kind of a big joke and a charade, right? What was everyone's sense of how things went?
I thought that the Democrats looked hapless for most of it. I mean, Lewandowski was gleefully stepping all over procedure, you know, using executive privilege that doesn't apply to him, as he never worked a day in the White House.
Yeah,
you know?
That part is just open and shut. It's bizarre.
Right.
You can't, I mean, so the whole, it's hard to know where to go from that. They're invoking something that I think everybody agrees cannot apply to someone who's just a pal.
Right, which, I mean, leaves you with, okay, what now? He says, you know, I'm shrouded in executive privilege. Democrats say, no, you're not. He says, yes, I am, not going to say anything. And then your 5 minutes are up, you know? I mean, it just made the whole thing such a charade.
Now, I was dealing with other matters. But what I heard, at least, was that at the end of the day, they finally got to the sort of the professional questioner, this staff guy. Mm-hmm. And at least as I heard about it, it was like a dramatically different picture then.
Yeah.
He like made mincemeat out of him, basically.
Absolutely.
But that was kind of after they'd spent a kind of a day just getting nowhere, and sort of after the, you know, after the storyline had been created, mm-hmm. as it were, that kind of like nothing happened. And then like from five on or something like that, this guy, and this is always the thing, you need to get a professional questioner and just have that person go, that your sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was already 5 hours in, so there was already a spate of headlines of, you know, Lewandowski, Stonewalls, blah, blah, blah. And then they brought in Barry Burke, who's their staff attorney. And he was just, you know, Lewandowski would try to evoke this executive privilege. And he would be like, well, you realize you wrote a book with these conversations in them. Isn't that true? You know, and he's the one who prompted him to say his line. I don't owe the media a candid conversation, or I don't hold myself to any kind of truth when I'm not under oath. So, I mean, after you get that question out, you're like, OK, so what are we doing here?
Now, what was it? Was it the fact that he had more continuity that Burke did, that he could, you know, that he wasn't locked into these 5 minute intervals? Was he just better prepared? Like, what was the difference?
I think the continuity is a big part of it. He had a half hour. So in what Lewandowski was doing for a lot of the Democratic questioning was being like, can you point out where in the report that is? And, you know, just using up all their time.
Right,
but then
right,
at the same time, I mean, the Democrats are still their politicians. Like, they want their moment, you know, they tend towards monologue. And then you have this guy who's got no agenda other than poking holes in a witness.
Right.
That's true.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, the hearing was on most of the cable networks for a decent part of the afternoon. Mm-hmm. It's not like there was a ton of their riveting television to be programmed. But then, yeah, I guess the last part of it was between 6 and 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the Lewandowski media line, I want to drill into that a little bit because Kate and Nicole, you both work the early shift at TPM, right? You're up with the sun, if not earlier. And Lewandowski gets up and says, yeah, I don't need to be honest with the media. I'm not under any obligation to do that. And then CNN turns around and does what?
Well, they booked him. I mean, to be fair, he was also on Fox and Friends before that.
And the Martha McCallum one.
Yeah, the last evening.
So. Okay, yeah.
CNN wasn't the only culprit.
Right. So the media says, all right, he's going to not be honest or forthright or whatever, and that's cool. We'll just have him on TV anyways.
Right. I mean, and CNN tried to kind of introduce this with, like, you know, we're going to take the hammer to Lewandowski. You just wait. And it's just, there's nothing you can do in the face of someone who has no qualms about lying, you know? So it's him and Allison Camerota. They get in these endless back and forth where, you know, he's just going, Allison, you know, you're being disingenuous.
Was John Berman also?
I think he was just listening. Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, the whole thing was just, I mean, he's gleeful about it. It's hard to watch because it's only damaging.
Yeah, that's one thing and that came out in the sort of limited portions of his testimony that I was able to listen to yesterday. It's not just that they're invoking these, you know, facially non-existent privileges. I mean, it just doesn't apply. It's also that they're in, you know, it is part of their thing, the sort of the Trump administration thing, that they don't want to just get through the hearings without you know, having to reveal anything, they are trying to basically tell the committee to fuck themselves, mm-hmm. and to sort of taunt them with their inability to make them follow the rules. And that is really, that's really the essence of it. It's not like, I mean, if you look at like the body language and all of this, it's not like, you know, Lewandowski sort of dragged up there and he's hating it. And
tail between his legs.
Yeah, and yeah. kind of like, and he's like, you know, kind of plead the fifth. He's enjoying it. And it's for an audience of Trump to kind of say, here, I'm here as your proxy, telling them to fuck themselves and enjoying it.
And speaking of, Trump tweeted after Lewandowski's opening statement that it was a beautiful opening statement by Lewandowski. So obviously the message got through.
Well, I mean, and it's just like there was one segment on his CNN appearance this morning where he says, you know, no collusion, no exoneration. And Allison Camerota is like, you said yesterday that you didn't read the report. And he's like, well, that's true. But are you saying we shouldn't trust Attorney General Barr? It's just like to the point where this is not newsworthy. This is not even like pleasant viewing. It's
right,
just
right,
horrific.
Right.
And it's giving him a platform because he's running, well, not officially, but planning very openly to run for Senate in New Hampshire.
Yeah, that's a good point to add.
Is there like another person who's going to run, or is it pretty much when he decides he's going to be the candidate? Is that, do we know?
I'm not sure.
I haven't really seen other
prospective candidates. It's Shaheen, right?
Yeah.
That's who's up for the Democrats.
Right.
It wasn't, I mean, it's hard to imagine that Trump wouldn't like, you know, dump all over whoever, anybody else who wants to run if Lewandowski wants to run. But I would have to imagine that, you know, there's a Senate committee that is in charge of like winning Senate seats. Mm-hmm. And in general, I think people think she's, you know, she's in relatively good, you know, fairly good shape. It's hard for me to imagine that is the best they can put forward. I mean, I think it'll be hard for the Republicans to win that seat in general.
Right.
But he is just like,
I mean, he's ridiculous.
He's ridiculous. And his whole thing is, you know, catering to the sort of the 25% of the electorate mm-hmm. that is not just, you know, anti-Democrat enough to support the president, but the kind of people who were there with, you know, at you know, Trump rallies with signs say like, you know, fuck your feelings, right? That kind of, that sort of transgressive,
yeah,
hyper-Trumpist sort of thing.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And that's not going to, that's not a New Hampshire kind of thing. I mean, New Hampshire is sort of old line Republican, mm-hmm. and then a lot of newer sort of transplants from Boston and Connecticut and stuff, you know, stuff like that. It's there's definitely a sort of a Trump constituency there, but it's hard for me to imagine that if you are whoever's running the Senate committee in the Senate this cycle, that's what, you know, that's the race you want to run.
Yeah. Now that you say that, I kind of recall seeing something to that effect.
There was when it came out that he was attending the Trump rally with Trump.
Right.
There was all this like on the record reporting that came out that state Republicans were willingly saying we don't yeah. want this candidate.
Interesting.
Yeah,
interesting,
I believe it. I think it was Politico that had that.
Interesting. I mean, again, it doesn't surprise me. You've got like, you know, you have. It's funny how that state works. There are like three families that totally dominate the Republican Party. There's the Judds. There's the Sununus. I think, what is it? Isn't there like a new Sununu's governor now or something?
Yeah.
Okay, right. And he's like the third generation. I mean, literally, I think maybe he may be John Sununu's grandson. Because John Sununu's son was, I don't know if he was senator. They've all been all, you know, all the offices. So, yeah, it really, I mean, A, he has no history. I mean, he's from the state, but he has no history kind of like in the state Republican
right.
Party as like
right.
a player. So just at the level of, you know, we want one of our guys to get
yeah.
to get the shot. But just also at the level of winning, I can't imagine. I mean, someone was saying during the commentary yesterday, like that whole thing, like, you know, would be like the tagline on every ad against him. I have no responsibility to tell the truth.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, totally. To me, it kind of feels like the Lewandowski Senate idea comes from he's been in a lot of TV green rooms. He has this affiliation with Trump. It's just sort of like, yeah, why, you know, I'm awesome. Why wouldn't I Why wouldn't I try to put my hat in the ring?
I mean, he's the Brad Parscale of senators,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, he really is,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
I mean, it's just, you know, how did he ever, you know, like, I mean, not quite as bad as Parscale, but he had never succeeded in anything in politics. And he was just kind of glommed onto as someone, you know, some name they could come up with
to
be the campaign manager.
I mean, in the Republican,
but he hit it off with Trump.
In the Republican primary in 2016, obviously it was a huge field. I mean, similar to what we're seeing on the Democratic side today, all the professional political operatives were linked up with more actual legit politicians at the time.
Right. Speaking of elections, do we want to do the update here?
Sure. Do you want to fill us in on what happened last week in North Carolina?
Yeah. So we talked pretty extensively last week about what to expect, and the results came out that the Republican Dan Bishop won with 50.7% of the vote to the Democrat Dan McCready's 48.7. So, I mean, kind of what we were saying last week, you know, Republicans should have won in a blowout. They won by 2 points, a district that Trump won by 12, 2016. So, you know, that's not good for news for them. It's not as cataclysmic as if the Democrat had won. And there are some hopeful signs for Democrats in the future. Bishop did poorly in the suburbs. There's continual sliding there, which is, you know, kind of the battlefield where a lot of these House elections will be fought. You know, and then by that same token, it's not all bleak for Republicans, though. While Bishop slid in the suburbs, McCready slid in the rural areas, showing even greater polarization there. And Democrats invested a lot in turning out primarily black counties, and those totals really didn't move much at all from the first round voting in 2018.
Is he given any signs of whether he's going to try this again in 2020, McCready?
McCready?
Yeah.
Not in his speech, but I mean, well, he's been campaigning for 2 years, so maybe he'll take a week off reconsider.
I'm just thinking, because it's you know, special elections are weird.
Mm-hmm.
They have lower turnout. I mean, this one had very high turnout for a special election, but I think it was still significantly under the turnout for the 2018 election.
They were also having some Hurricane Dorian fallout there, so the weather sucked.
And it's
too.
Right at the end of summer, people aren't necessarily super engaged over the, you know, off months.
Yeah, I mean, I could see, I mean, it you know, from one perspective, it sort of seems like, all right, man, you tried twice.
It didn't happen.
It didn't happen, mm-hmm. and it's a really hard district, so sort of like, you know, maybe it's time to pack it in. But there's also at least an argument that, you know, really damn close, a couple times, and in a general election, you've got, you know, it's possible you have a better, you know, an electorate that has a better shape to it or something like that. So I'm curious whether he would try again.
I mean, I also think this race kind of has echoes of the special election in Georgia 6. That was John Ossoff and Karen Handel.
Yep.
And, you know, that got so much attention, especially because the timing of it. And Ossoff fell short, but you know, that's the district that Lucy McBath won in 2018. So it is kind of like
there's a ripple effect.
Right. And incremental ground being won that even, you know, maybe not this time, but maybe the next time, you know, Democrats will have more infrastructure in place, or the suburbs will be even wearier of Trump, you know.
Right, right. Well, there's also the possibility, I mean, I don't know this is what happened. I mean, there's a lot of different arguments, but one theory of what happened in the Georgia 6 race is that in, you know, the spring of 2017 or whenever that was, there was huge energy on the part of the Democrats. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it was the only game in town. So Republicans could just put everything in there and just, you know, clobber the Democrats with like tons of outside spending. And that does seem like what they did here.
Yeah.
And in a general election, there's going to be a lot of other stuff going on. There's the presidential, there's a million competitive House districts. So a race like that can sort of not slip under the radar. People know it's happening, but you just can't put everything into it.
Exactly.
So I'm curious whether he chooses to run again. I mean, it would be, if he didn't, it would certainly seem logical that it would draw another serious candidate.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're that close, you know, I don't know. There's certainly an argument that with Trump on the ticket, maybe that's an advantage for the Republicans in North Carolina, but not necessarily. It's hard
to say. I think is the thing that's hardest to parse here is, you know, did Trump and Pence swooping in at the last minute pull Bishop over the line?
Right.
You know, was that an infusion of enthusiasm they needed? Did that turn out the suburbs more than they would have? You know, those intangibles are hard to tell.
Right, right, right.
Okay, shifting gears a little bit to our next topic. This week, the Columbia Journalism Review and The Nation magazine, along with dozens of other news organizations, are kind of doing a collective, coordinated week of coverage on climate change. It's a topic that's traditionally been a little bit tough to get audiences to really care about. It's something that impacts all of us, you know, especially living on the coast. But it always felt like the impacts or the most dire consequences were kind of far in the future, and that's becoming less the case now. I wanted to bring in our TPM's managing editor, John Light, to kind of share just a little bit of TPM's participation in the project and then talk about a piece Nicole just published on some of the Trump administration's efforts to roll back any progress or protections that the Obama administration had regarding the environment.
Thanks, David. This is a cool thing they've put together. It's, as you were saying, it's a project that I think grew out of CJR's, the Columbia Journalism Review's editor-in-chief, Kyle Pope, and The Nation's climate guy, Mark Hertzgard. And they've got 250 journalistic organizations in countries around the world committing to do a week of focused climate coverage. And the peg for this thing has been, you know, in news, you always want to have like a event, basically an excuse for why you're covering this now, is that the UN is having an event to try and draw attention to this. Trump is just blowing it off. And the UN has been kind of beating this drum for 30 years. So it's, you know, it's a little depressing to see kind of the same thing happen as, you know, the effects of climate change start to arrive, and still it's hard to get collective action. But the Paris Agreement 3 years ago was a thing. Trump wants to pull the U.S. out of it. The question kind of lingering over all of this is whether the rest of the world will kind of move forward without us. So in keeping with that, we had this piece this week that Nicole put together, kind of looking at the Trump administration has been moving really fast this summer to just achieve a bunch of its priorities to throw out climate regulations. So, Nicole, do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I think last week I started calling around to a bunch of climate experts and spoke to a few different people who kind of, I mean, I'm not a climate expert by any means. I just, you know, I'm curious about the topic and I read about it. And basically had them kind of divide out what they think the most damaging things that the Trump administration has done so far this summer. And one of the first things most people cited was the rollback of the George W. Bush era law that basically made it so that by 2020 we would phase out incandescent and halogen light bulbs for more energy efficient models. And the Obama administration put rules in place for what that would look like. And the Trump administration last, I think it was earlier this month, basically put a stop to that. So it was intended to roll out in January 2020, and it's not happening now. There's a lot of rationale for why. Trump kind of said that he didn't think it would save as much money as it was intended to for consumers, and consumers wouldn't have as much choice. He also made some joke about how LED lights make him look orange, which is like just very laughable.
One of the interesting things with this, I think, is that, you know, Congress will make a law. There's that kind of broad mandate, but then so much of what it looks like in practice is up to how the EPA or the agency writes the rules. We see this again with the light bulb thing. It's got to do something about light bulbs. But what that means is completely open to whoever's running the EPA at any given time. And an interesting part of your piece, I thought, Nicole, was that you were saying that, in fact, the guy running it right now, Andrew Wheeler, we hear much less about him, but he's far more effective than Scott Pruitt, who was just kind of always stepping in it and, you know, didn't actually get as much done as this guy, Wheeler, a former lobbyist who really knows his way around.
Right. And he's only been, well, he took over when Pruitt was ousted, but he's been the official head since February when he was confirmed and has done significantly more with far less negative media coverage.
It also seems like, and this may not be the case here, but there's been this, I mean, a lot of what the Trump administration is doing here is, at least from Trump's point of view, it's just to undo things Obama did.
Right.
Obviously, there's a lot of corporate, ideological heft behind rolling these things back. But a theme that's come up, and it came up with the auto companies and a number of different places, where corporate America has actually moved on in a lot of cases.
Right.
And so they're actually doing things that they're not getting pushed by sort of corporate lobbies in a lot of cases. And it's, one example is even with the oil companies now, I was doing some reporting on this a few months ago, that in a lot of cases, the oil companies, all of which are international by definition, they operate, they drill everywhere, they sell everywhere. In it's not, they're obviously still the problem in a fossil fuel, in terms of fossil fuels, but they've stopped saying, oh, there's no global warming, stopped saying, oh, we can't do wind or stuff like this. They're, they've got their angle. But since every other part of the world is kind of just in a different place, most of them have kind of said, whatever. What's happening in the U.S. is just this, you're just the odd man out. So we're not going to, focus our regulatory politics on this kind of island of denial in the United States. And then there was this thing with the auto companies where the Trump administration wanted to kind of roll back these regulations that, you had to have higher fuel efficiency. And basically the auto companies were like, dude, we've already done this. So what's the point? And they cut this deal with California. So I don't know specifically what it is with the light bulbs, but a lot of this is being driven by Trump's personal motives, which are to kind of undo anything Obama did, and then kind of ideological, ideologues, as opposed to, because again, in a lot of cases, corporate America has kind of moved on. Mm-hmm. And, there's other things they want to stop, but it's not these things.
Right. I mean, the Trump is so pissed about the auto thing that now those car companies who spoke to California and figured this thing out, they're the subject of, I think, an antitrust.
Which is crazy. Yeah. It's an extreme interpretation of the antitrust. It's clearly payback. And it is something that Bill Barr and people, they're just happy to kind of follow where he wants to go.
Yeah. And I would just add that today at some point, it's the EPA is announcing that they're not going to allow California to make its own rules about emissions and car efficiency anymore.
Or any state.
Or any state. It's across the board, but specifically California, because this has been in place since the 1970s. And
it's hard to imagine that standing up. That is such a, it's so embedded into the whole system.
Right.
That now, do they have a, I mean, they must have, California must be going to fight that in the courts, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's multiple state officials and environmental groups that are in line to immediately challenge it.
But wasn't that part of the automakers' motivations, too, for just sticking to certain efficiency or emissions standards, is because they thought that Trump rolling it back would end up in courts anyways, and that they would just basically need to be kind of like ready to, kind of scale things back or comply with, whatever kind of restrictions in that. Trump saying, no, we're doing things my way, they just thought maybe wouldn't stick.
Well, it's always, the advantage of, it's sort of like there's a similar thing with Texas and textbooks, right? Texas is so big, the way their education system is set up is they kind of buy textbooks as a state, which gives Texas and the people on the state education board in Texas this basically like Texas decides what's going to be in textbooks for the whole country because it's such a big market. And that's always the power that California's had, because yes, it's only California, but if you're an automaker, you're like, dude, we're not going to not sell our cars in 10% right. of the country.
Not like Los Angeles is a big walking city.
Yeah, either, that's just not possible. So it's always been for people who care about environmental protection, California is kind of leading the way on this. Has always been a really big deal. I cannot imagine that will either make it in the courts or will not be changed in the next administration. It's just I just don't buy it.
It's a very nice example of the pure conservative ideology of states' rights, though. It's nice to see the president really staying true to what he truly believes.
Right. So, Nicole, just to round out the reporting you've been doing, you had these five kind of, you know, terrible news points, but there was sort of a glimmer of hope that you included at the end of your piece. So tell us about what's the silver lining potentially.
Well, it's actually kind of exactly what we're talking about, because some of these deregulatory measures are centered on industries that have already created, you know, with the auto industry, they've already created their 2021, 2022 models for vehicles. And so if anything, at the end of the day, if Trump doesn't win re-election, the deregulatory measures that he's put into place aren't going to go anywhere, especially if a Democrat wins. But so they're largely reversible, according to many of the experts I talked to.
So. And so, John, does that go kind of to your point that because Congress is in action, it's left up to the agencies to kind of figure out what they want to do? Are we just going to ping pong back and forth in between administrations? Republican or Democrat is sort of like, all right, this administration will actually do something, and if a Republican is in office, basically we'll just go backwards?
In terms of rules on the books, I think that's right. But I mean, to Josh and Nicole's point, the rest of the world is smarter. The BPs and Shells of the world and the car companies of America and the world, they see this trend that the U.S. is bouncing back and forth, and they're just not going to participate in that game. And one of the most interesting things, I think, with like the global effort to deal with climate stuff is even with the Paris Agreement, Trump says we're out, but we're not actually out because they built in a thing where you can't leave for 4 years.
Right.
So the Paris Agreement went into effect on November 4th, 2016. The election was November 8th. Trump comes in. That means that we're not officially out until November 4th, 2020, one day after the next U.S. presidential election. So, you know, the world is onto our game here.
Also, I would say that, and we don't know how this will play out, but there were a few polls in the last week, and it's clear that within the United States, public opinion has moved dramatically just over the last, like, 18 months, basically. I don't like to just do polls from memory, but the number of people who basically say, yes, climate change is real, and it's being driven by man-made, emissions was up to like 80 or 90%. I mean, crazy number. And the number of people who see it as a crisis, an immediate crisis, was something like 45%. So you do kind of, we just see these things happening every day. These storms.
This summer, I mean, wasn't July the hottest July ever on record? And it seems like it happens basically every summer.
Yeah. And again, a lot of it is the extreme weather is not the only part of it, but it's hard to ignore. You see these things again and again, and you just like, unless you have some like profound ideological commitment to just refusing to believe any of this.
Unless you're Jim Inhofe or something.
Yeah, at a certain point, you're just like, okay, clearly something is happening. This has always been a kind of a bugbear of mine. It's interesting the way that people, especially groups of people, come up with the ideas they come up with to give themselves fallbacks not to believe certain things they don't want to believe. And one of the things you see in the last, it used to be 10, 15 years ago, it's sort of like, hey, man, summer, winter, same as it's always been. I don't know what you guys are talking about. And then there was this thing about, sure, there is climate change. I just don't think it's man-made. And you're just like, well, okay. I mean, set aside the science. Let's just think about logically. Like, is that really plausible that just kind of all of a sudden when there is this kind of thing that is a logical culprit that we are doing? And then the other thing is, again, I've always think it's so funny. Let's say that, because climate does change for reasons that aren't driven by humans over, geologic time. Let's say that it just was getting hotter, right? It would follow like, okay, let's do everything to kind of like kind of tamp down our contribution to it, because if it gets hotter, it's not like it's okay just because we didn't do it. We're still here. It's still a bummer for us. Anyway, it's just one of these funny things about how people come up with these fallbacks for inaction or just not wanting to to end up needing to believe things they are committed to not believing.
Right. I just one final question on this topic for the group, anyone who wants to take a stab at it. Just going to the point I kind of made at the outset, which is that, you know, climate coverage feels like it's increased. We have this Climate Change Now project happening at the moment. It's a week of sustained coverage. But how do we get people to really engage in the topic long term? What about after this week is done, or, you know, once it's winter again in, you know, most parts of the country and, I don't know, think life goes back to normal? How do we kind of sustain that energy, do you think?
Well, we have, I will say, you know, it is always a hot part of the year somewhere, and there is extreme weather that goes beyond heat and really violent storms. There's we've had it's hard to say exactly that it's climate change, but we have had these spurts of extremely cold weather.
That's true.
And these polar vortexes.
Part of the country Nicole and I hail from,
right,
negative 60 degree wind chills and
right, which
like
are
that.
which are supposed to be part of the sort of the climate instability. I mean, again, you can never point to any one thing as clearly being the case. I mean, there's even things that I wonder about that I know gets talked about sort of on the margins of the climate change debate, that even things like the Gulf Stream, there doesn't have to be a Gulf Stream exactly where it is right now, which is basically what keeps, like, our whole kind of weather system is based on there being a Gulf Stream. It's also why England is basically habitable as opposed to being like Norway or something like that, right? Because you have the Gulf Stream, it comes up and it basically keeps England warmish. So there are other things that just basic cyclic climate patterns changing that you could have that, like, I don't know, you know, you could if you're invested in igloos for England, you could do well.
Yeah, I mean, to that point, I think increasingly, to answer your question, David, we're not going to have much of a choice. I think maybe 10 years ago it would have been a question of how to get people to care through the winter, but now there's just a disaster all the time. And I think the trend is becoming apparent, so much so that you even got, like, Republicans in Florida who need to, you know, we've got Matt Gaetz talking about climate change now, I think, you know.
And in his defense, he's not like an advocate, but basically I was struck, like, it was like a year or so ago. I mean, because he's nuts on everything, right? But it was true that on climate change, like, yep, it's real. We got to do something about it. And again, it's kind of not saying much in Florida because it's obviously affecting Florida. And Florida is like the top state where, like, a lot of it probably in half a century won't be above water anymore. So, like, it's a big deal. But you do have, and there's, you know, that, was it Tom Tillis in North Carolina? Mm-hmm. Or one of the, maybe it was Burr, I don't know. Basically, even some of them are starting to shift.
Yeah. All right, John, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, shifting to our last topic for today, we've had what was dominating the news really for the whole week until Corey Lewandowski got in front of cameras and in front of the House Judiciary Committee was this new report, a book that came out on Justice Kavanaugh and the confirmation process and the sexual misconduct allegations that he faced, like we said, about exactly a year ago when he was nominated to the Supreme Court. So, two New York Times reporters published a new book on the Kavanaugh sort of saga, and there's been a lot of kind of weird circumstances surrounding it. I think one of the biggest, I don't know, revelations of their reporting seems to be that there was a sort of unknown or a new allegation against Kavanaugh that surfaced in the midst of their reporting. It was another story from Kavanaugh's Yale days where he allegedly, like, exposed himself and thrust him, you know, his body, his penis in front of, like, a woman at a party, and apparently some other kind of classmates or people at the party saw this. This was kind of buried in the Times piece, right? I think it was something like the ninth paragraph or something before it came out. And set off, you know, a lot of, I don't know, hand-wringing among people responding to the story. Why was this kind of just not an afterthought, but just downplayed in the story in general? It was, the story itself was accompanied by a totally ridiculous tweet that said something like, you know, waving your penis in front of someone at a party might sound like harmless fun, but...
Well, it was basically, it might seem like harmless fun, but not to this girl who had the penis pushed in her face. And everybody was like, what the heck?
Right, you know, but it reaffirmed her insecurity at Yale, as if getting exposed to made her feel not part of the cool crowd, you know?
And the funny thing is, I thought I read now that it was actually Pogrebin, one of the authors who either wrote the tweet.
He did I saw that report.
Okay,
as well.
Yeah, that either that or that it was basically cribbed from the book. That was kind of her language.
I think you're right that the reporter wrote the tweet. It was supposed to have been, you know,
vetted, quote unquote,
approved, whatever.
I mean, not to get too but it just is a graphic thing. There's no way to avoid it. One of the things you said, like, at least as this has been presented to us, this isn't waving, you're at a party, you're over there, this guy's on the other side of the room and he exposes himself. It sounds more like he pushed his penis in her face, right? Those are very different. I mean, they both are not okay, but they're very different things.
And that's what's so infuriating about the way the New York Times handled everything about this, the top to bottom, is that the bulk of the story was intense reporting that corroborated Deborah Ramirez's accusation, which was of a similar nature, that he pushed his penis into her face. And this new one was that it was pushed in her hand.
Right.
I mean, that's behavior is singular. And, you know, to have it come up in multiple stories like this, you know, lends credence to especially Ramirez's story, which is just... That is a huge thing, you know, that an accusation that the FBI flatly did not bother investigating is now, you know, looking more and more credible. They got 7 people who remembered this happening before Kavanaugh became a federal judge.
And the Ramirez story you're talking about.
The Ramirez story, right.
Because there was a detail that came out about this other story, this other allegation, that the woman who this allegedly happened to says she doesn't remember the incident, but that it was recounted to the reporters by... friends or classmates or something.
Which is what makes the handling of it so irresponsible, because this is exactly what happened during the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, is you had Christine Blasey Ford, who anyone who's watching that does not doubt her credibility. You know, her story makes sense. She has nothing to gain from this, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and then you have Michael Avenatti, who cannot resist thrusting himself into the spotlight for 2 seconds, who's like throwing around these other claims that either aren't substantiated or, you know, hasn't done the groundwork to kind of present this complete package. The Republicans, you know, grab onto that with all their might and see, look at these people trying to destroy this man. And then they don't have to bother with the woman who is exhibiting, you know, the highest form of bravery, coming in front of the world and telling her story. They instead get to cling onto this lesser story and completely twist the narrative. And that's exactly what happened now. And Democrats aren't talking about anymore. On the Monday floor speeches on the Senate, McConnell spent his entire time saying, like, oh, poor Kavanaugh, this world is trying to pull him apart. Chuck Schumer did not even address it. It just, everything about it is so infuriating.
It seems to me that I think the original mistake here for the Times is they took reported copy. Fine, it's a book, but it's still reporting. They put it in the opinion section as kind of like an excerpt from their reporter's book. And so it's not for the Times, so they don't do it as reported stuff. They kind of put it over in the opinion section. That leads to kind of big new news being like buried in the piece, A. It probably also led to... My understanding of what happened here is that an editor, probably editing for length or something like that, just kind of cut out the part about this second alleged, or I don't know if it's at least of the two party kind of, you know, pushing himself onto people, victims, that she does not remember it. Now, maybe she just is saying that because she just doesn't want to be involved. Maybe she was drunk and doesn't remember. Who knows? You know, it doesn't. But it certainly, it is an important part of the story. There's no question about it. And it seems like all of these things, I think, stem from running in the opinion section. That it would have been edited differently. There would have been more attention to. All right, we have to kind of focus on what is the big news, not this stuff about, you know, class politics and yuppie, you know,
social standing and stuff,
and preppies and all that kind of stuff, that there's something in here that's really big. So as you say, the Times just screwed this up on so many different
levels. There was some reporting that these two reporters, I mean, I guess there's lots of there's some gray area when you write a book and you're a New York Times employee, but you're on book leave and this reporting is for a book publisher, it's not for the paper, so there's not like a perfect formula for your book project going into the paper. The New York Times pointed out that it's common for book excerpts, you know, from New York Times reporters to appear in the Sunday Review, which is the kind of weekend opinion section. There was also reporting, I think in Vanity Fair, correct me if I'm wrong, that this story was pitched to the news section, to news editors, and that they passed on it. And that's how it ultimately ended up in the opinion section, because the opinion section operates independently from the newsroom.
Right,
that's
right.
Something that maybe kind of casual news consumers don't totally understand is that the editorial board, the op-ed, any opinion thing, at least in a traditional newspaper setting, is walled off, sometimes on different floors, totally different.
And definitely there. They run by, they have two totally different chains of command.
Right.
I think it's one of those things, though, that, yes, all of those things make sense. Pitched it to here, over there, it's different standards. I think what they're kind of hinting at there is when we're publishing an excerpt, it's really the publisher's responsibility to make sure everything's true and kind of we're just publishing it. At the end of the day, though, none of that cuts it.
Yeah.
It appeared in the New York Times. These distinctions really don't mean anything and frankly should not have to mean anything to the public. This is all insider stuff. Who's in charge of what and stuff. I mean, we have had, I mean, obviously nothing at this level, but we've had things at TPM where in terms of like the internal operations of TPM, well, it happened because of this and because of that. And we don't vet that kind of, and like, dude, no one cares.
Right.
It appears under in your publication.
I just wonder how much it would have mattered if that initial clarification had been in there, though. I mean, I think that Trump would have, and, you know, Republicans would have seized on the, well, this woman doesn't remember it, and she didn't want to be interviewed, so this isn't a credible allegation. And then Democrats would have, you know, well, regardless, this is something that a credible person remembers, and kind of adds fuel to this, the Deborah Ramirez allegation. So I feel like it would have been partisan either way, the response, but I'm just curious how much it would have mattered.
Yeah, it's a good point. What also mucks it up a little bit is that, just to get back kind of to the strange internal procedures, was that apparently it wasn't a strict excerpt. It was an essay that the authors kind of adapted from their reporting for the newspaper. So it's not like it was a copy and paste kind of thing.
They were trying
to cobble together, here's what our reporting found. And
I think they are saying, the authors say that in the book, this is clear.
Right.
That she doesn't remember it. So, yeah, it's a mess. I mean, I just to your point, Nicole, I mean, absolutely. I think that defenders of Kavanaugh would have brought that up. It is a significant part of the story. There's no getting around that. And there's just no undoing if you don't include it. And then you say, we should have included this. Now we're including it. It's hard to get past that. I will say that it did, my sense is, even from a non-Kavanaugh defending sort of point of view, the way it originally ran, and I think the perceptions that came to it over the weekend were sort of like, oh, buried down in the piece, it looks, seems like you completely confirmed yet another allegation that is highly, highly relevant to this. You know, as you said, it adds a lot of, you know, kind of confirmation or mm-hmm. you know, it beefs up Ramirez's story. And again, it was just kind of buried there and sort of like, you know, a million witnesses, it happened, we confirmed it. I think you can still say that, but if the person who is the victim doesn't remember it, that's part of it. That can't not be part of it. So I think it would have played a little differently. I don't think fundamentally it would have been different, but I think it would have played a little differently.
And I just think it's such a shame because there are huge nuggets of news in that without the third allegation. You know, I mean, the FBI's complete disinterest in even pretending to investigate these claims are, I mean, shocking and, you know, horrific, especially for the women watching this. You know, what kind of trust does that put in our law enforcement system? But, you know, I think part of this also, which is really hard, is you like hear this new story and all these emotions are riled up again, especially if it was hard for you to watch this the first time around, for which, you know, many women in our newsroom it was. And now it's again, you know, he probably was this horrible person, and you're like, okay, well, he's on the Supreme Court now.
For
impeachment hasn't happened in centuries, you know, and it's just so, I don't, it just makes you feel so impotent, you know.
I would say one thing that I think is fair to say about the FBI is it was clear at the time that the brief given to them made it, they were basically told not to do that. They were given a brief that I can't remember what it was exactly. They were given a very narrow question, basically just to, I think basically to talk to, you know, to talk to Blasey Ford, to talk to that other guy who was part of the incident with her. And like, that was it. So my only point of bringing it up is that I don't think it's like the FBI per se. They were given marching orders that was, the cover up was kind of baked in. Right. They were told not to do that. And that, I think, puts the responsibility where it belongs, which is basically at the Department of Justice and at the White House. They you know, there was that whole thing with Senator Flake. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not going to vote yes until there's
Chris Coons.
Right. And that whole kind of drama, unless there's an investigation. They got them to yield, but then they came up with this brief to investigate, which basically meant that unless they went to that guy and said, hey, would you like to talk? Unless he said, you know what, I would love to talk. You know, unless that happened, which was clearly never going to happen, that they'd be like, oh,
right,
that was it. Couldn't come up with anything.
I mean, when this story initially came out, just to kind of tie things back to what we were talking about at the top of the show, a bunch of 2020 Democrats called for Kavanaugh's impeachment. Kate, like you say, since the kind of New York Times drama has been unfolding, Democrats have gone pretty quiet on that. But I thought maybe we could just end by kind of tying it into Democrats' impeachment efforts in general. There was some new reporting in Politico this morning kind of about tensions between Nadler and Pelosi. And kind of wondering where you guys think things stand there.
Yeah, I mean, I alluded to this earlier, but I think, you know, they're close. They've served together for a long time, but I'm wondering how this division is tenable in their personal relationship at this point, just because, you know, like we said, Nadler gave a WNYC radio interview this week where he said that he personally is for impeachment, but, you know, it's his committee's job to win over the will of the people and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, he is hampered from being fully on Pelosi's page right now because they've got different jobs. It's Pelosi's job to protect the freshmen who are from moderate districts and to do what's best for the majority of her caucus. It's her job to hold the House. You know, it's his job to run his committee and to win re-election while he's facing the most formidable primary challenge that he's had in recent history against this New York State lawmaker who's coming at him from the left and who is making significant money running on his reluctance to call for Trump's impeachment, you know? So they've got different motivations and they're serving different masters at the end of the day. So, I mean, it's hard to see how long the Democratic Party can kind of stagger along when two of the legs are going in different directions.
And Nicole, in this reporting this morning, there was a closed door meeting between the Pelosi was saying what was happening there.
I thought the most telling piece of information that came out of that Politico story was the fact that Pelosi told people in the meeting to leak the news that she was, unhappy with the way that Nadler was running the committee. And I mean, who knows what the motivation is there other than he just had this, you know, big time in front of the cameras yesterday with the Lewandowski hearing, and maybe it's her way of getting her foot back at the front of the disagreement.
I would say, too, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there is a true disagreement or a true unhappiness between them, tension or whatever. But I would say it sort of suits both of their interest to have this idea that they're kind of at odds, to allow them to kind of go in opposite directions and not have people saying, oh, how's that consistent? So I'm a little skeptical of the whole thing. I really do think it kind of, I think it serves both of their interests to kind of get some distance between them, mm-hmm. allow her to say, yeah, well, I mean, this, you know, we're not impeaching him. My caucus isn't impeaching him. He got this committee. They're doing their thing, you know, kind of whatever. And we're doing our thing. So I'm skeptical.
So you don't think the Dems in disarray headlines that this spawns hurts them?
You know, everything's relative. It's not, I mean, at a certain level, I think most of those kinds of headlines are only of interest to sort of people like us who work in the political news business mm-hmm. and people who are hardcore, you know, kind of political junkies who have very, you know, confirmed political beliefs to start with. It's not great. On the other hand, he really needs to be doing something. He needs it for his own personal, his own personal political future. He needs it for the Democrats in the caucus who really believe this is a deep issue of principle that has to happen. So he needs that. She needs to be able to kind of, you know, be saying her own thing, and to give these, you know, people in swing districts someone to point to, says, you know, we're not impeaching him. So I think that giving both of those sides the ability to kind of speak their piece is a greater advantage than sort of meta stories about, Dems in disarray. Because at a certain level, I mean, even at a substantive foundational level, does it even matter? Like, okay, there are some Democrats who really want to impeach the president, and there are others who don't. I mean, that's not that surprising. And she's the head of the caucus, and it's not even going to come to a floor vote if she doesn't say so. So that's, again, maybe she really is upset that he's kind of going further than she would like. But I'm just skeptical.
I guess my only thought in that vein is, at the time where the party, you know, who's got the White House, you know, is just so chaotic and so truly in disarray. Mm-hmm. That the narrative that the opposing party also can't get itself together, I would think could be unattractive to I don't know that a swing voter exists, but someone who isn't sold.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that would cause a throw your hands up, politics is broken. But maybe people who are inclined to think that already, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. And I will say too that relatively soon that the Democratic Party will become the nominee. We don't know who that's going to be, but that person will be the story. So yeah, I think there's something to it, but again, people can have, I'm just saying that it may be on balance in everybody's interest to get a little space.
And the nominee thing that's a good point, because at some stage this is a waiting game, right? It's like you push this, kick this can down the road till we have a nominee who says, who asks to impeach him, I'm going to beat him in a few months, you know, and it'll take care of itself.
And that I think is actually, although she won't say it explicitly, is in many ways Pelosi's actual point. The kind of like, we're just in this waiting game before there's a nominee, and we're right about to have an election.
Right.
So none of this is even going to happen. So, let's just kind of kick the can down the road, and soon the big story will be presidential primaries, the sort of the actual, you know, the election over Trump. So again, and this is I was having a conversation a little while ago with former high-ranking Judiciary Committee staffer who is not on the side that Pelosi is in on this, but really sees what she's doing as, I'll take some hits, but I just need to get this out of 2019, and then it's going to take care of itself.
Right.
Because then all the oxygen is about the general election, and if you really, you know, whatever outrage you have about Donald Trump, at that point, there's going to be a way for you to vent that outrage, and it'll be a general election. And you can say that is cynical, and if it is really that, you know, kind of, if that is sort of thinking, it is kind of cynical, but the calendar does have its own logic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. On that note.
All right. Okay. So remember, the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. If you're ready to give it a swirl, get 20% off your first order at Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. That's Grady'sColdBrew.com with promo code TPM. And remember, become a member of TPM. Subscribe to Prime. Subscribe to Prime ad-free. Subscribe to Inside. We have all these different options. We have a big sign-up drive coming in the second half of September that is really critical for TPM's future, and TPM is what puts on this podcast. So if you're a TPM reader, if you enjoy this podcast, please consider signing up and become a member of TPM. We even have a special offer for Josh Marshall Podcast listeners, and that is talkingpointsmemo.com/deal. And you get 20% off a membership. So do it. It's really important. And it supports the work that all of us do.
Yes, please.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Nicole.
See
thanks, Kate. Thanks, Josh.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.